Yeah.
Okay, everyone, it's just after six, so we'll get started. So welcome, councillors, welcome members of the public who are here with us this evening. Tonight we're here for the briefing session in advance of next week's June council meeting. To begin with, we always have an acknowledgement of country, and tonight I would just also like to express some gratitude, acknowledge the wonderful things that we have here in the town of Bassendean. I think sometimes, you know, we tend to stop and reflect upon how fortunate we are here. But also just to, as part of that gratitude, acknowledge what it has cost for each of us to be able to be here and live in such a wonderful place, particularly for the people who have gone before us. But mostly I'm thinking about the Whadjuk people, who are the traditional owners of the land here. So acknowledging them as the traditional custodians of the land that the town of Bassendean was founded on, and expressing gratitude for what the price that they have paid for us to be able to enjoy living here in the town. So tonight, Councillor Quinton has given her apologies. She's not able to join us. Thank you, everybody else, for being here. And next week, I think Councillor Gangell and Councillor Barty are both going to be absent for the council meeting. Are there any declarations from councillors for any items on tonight's agenda? Great. So in terms of announcements, I just wanted to bring everyone's attention to the decision that was made by council last month. So people may be aware that last year council supported putting an expression of interest out for interested parties who would have the capability to restore the properties at 1 Surrey Street, which is the Pensioner Guard Cottage and the adjacent residence. So last month council considered those submissions and supported the submission that had been made by the Museum of Perth. So just to let people know that we'll be commencing our public advertising of that this Friday, and it will be open until the 5th of July. So we'd encourage everybody to take a look at that and to provide us their feedback on that proposal, so that when it comes back to council for a final decision, we have that information to consider. So this evening we have time allocated for public questions and statements. So at the briefing session, the questions and statements are limited to items that are on tonight's agenda. At the council meeting next week, there's open question time for anything that relates to the local government business, but I'd ask that if anyone has any questions or statements tonight, that they raise their hand and I can ask you to come to the microphone so your comments or question can be clearly heard. And if you can just let us know your name and the agenda item that you would be speaking to. We had Mr. Phil Kelly here. No? Okay, so Mr. Kelly has submitted a statement in relation to item 7.8. Is that the signage? Yes. Yep. So his statement is, as president of the Ashfield Sports Club, I commend the revocation of existing council policy 5.22, reserve sponsorship signage. This will provide improved revenue opportunities for local clubs and community groups based at Ashfield, Jubilee and BIC reserves. Is there anybody present who would like to make a statement or ask a question on any other agenda item? Yes, Mr. Busby, would you like to come to the microphone?
Just on the food trucks, the mini markets, a moment to talk on that.
Yep, item 7.1.
Yep. Apologies, wasn't really going to come tonight, but Lizzie Richardson's crook in hospital and the lady that runs Needful Foods undergoing chemotherapy, so I thought it was good to come down. As a vice president of the Ashfield Sports Club, we'd like to leave the concerns on the council's approval of these night markets bi-weekly. We train on a Thursday night and our car parking is limited and the average street lighting is creating a danger. Cars and people are dangerous mix at night. Basically, people are walking down Colston towards the shops. It's dark, there's a lot of trees, the lighting's not 100%, and people with extra cars are pushing the prams on and off the footpath to cross over. A lot of the kids have got dark clothing on, bits and pieces. Nothing's happened so far. Because people park all over the place when there's an event on there. Walking on the roads, pushing babies and strollers and reaching them on the dark street. The streets are not controlled at all, so there's no policing or that sort of thing. Hopefully nothing happens. There's been approvals given to these events that are taking business away from the Ashfield drivers. a kebab shop in Leaferfeet. Leaferfeet do a special fish and chips on a Friday night, and they've sort of said to me that if people come down on a Thursday night and have fish and chips, they're not likely to do the same the next day, so that's adversely affecting them. IGA loses their car parks, they're open till 9, people park and work across the truck markets. Chemist is open till 7, he loses his parking issue, so that's regular, good things happen there. The vendors are charging, we don't know what prices for what they're giving the takeaways. I've been down there, I think there's insufficient rubbish bins. What the vendors bring in is very small. The fuel generators are noisy and fuel fumes are spread into the air. My knowledge on the bins comes from the 20 or 30 years I've spent running the Hyde Park there with the Rotary Club of North Perth. A lot of the vendors will bring stuff in and may or may not clean up. There's litter left in the very small tables, so it's not cleaned immediately, because people even have it inside the sports club. People will have a meal, eat something, leave it there, kids, rubbish. It's left there for a while. There was no consultation. When I found out about it, I was told by council staff they spoke at the Ashfield shops. I went to spoke at the Ashfield shops. They were not only told, they were actually, there was no consultation. So that's disappointing from a council that promotes consultation and inclusivity. We've had for years now the Bassendean markets that are supported by the Menshed and the Rotary Club. These are two not-for-profit organisations that support the community over many years in many ways. The Rotary Club did in fact donate 10,000 to the Ashfield Can on the condition of using the Gary Lane's Park. A Rotary sign is well used in assessing issues, and this is what I see with the town of Bassendean and the local vendors. Is it fair to all concerned? If they're small businesses, they're not big businesses, and they need support rather than competition. So would councillors give some accountability and transparency and consider the business needs and our sports club, because I now see in the minutes there's a possibility of a special licence being granted. We fought for 15 years to tidy up the Ashfield Sports Club from an alcohol point of view. When I got there, there was a lot of extra alcohol being consumed off the premises. That doesn't happen anymore.
Mr. Busby, I'm going to have to ask you to wrap up in a moment, please.
So not compromised anyway. And the fact that we've got to have alcohol, even the doors with a meal, you've got the street up to them 2 or 3 days a week, possibly not a good mix. We've got a sports club nearby, happy to support whatever the town wants to do, but we need consultation. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Busby. Is there anybody else who would like to ask a question or speak? Okay, then we'll move on to deputations. So we've got a couple of people who have indicated they'd like to speak tonight. So on item 7.4, which relates to the tree preservation order, is it Mr. Bell that's going to speak?
Yes.
Yep, please come forward. Is there a chair there? Would you prefer to sit at the table or speak into the microphone?
I can speak into the microphone.
Okay, thank you. So you've got up to 10 minutes, okay? So
yeah, sure.
Statement that I should read earlier, sorry, in relation to the same item from Tracy Brown of 3 Walter Road East, saying, I'd like to register my support for a tree protection order to be approved by the council at 47 7th Avenue, Bassendean, which is the property Mr. Bell was just referring to. This flooded gum is home to over 100 different bird species. I have a 180-degree uninterrupted view of this tree from my property by 3 Walter Road East. In particular, the Carnaby cockatoos are nesting in this tree. This tree needs protection. It recently rapidly deteriorated after an alleged deliberate incident by a third party. It is unacceptable that trees such as this can be sabotaged. Actions to ensure the tree remains safe should be overseen by the council. I vote to approve the tree preservation order. As Mr. Busby indicated earlier, Lizzie Richardson, representing Chaos Theory Events, had intended to be here this evening to speak to item 7.1, which relates to the food truck event. She's unable to be here this evening, but councillors should all have received an email from her stating her position in opposition to the officer recommendation. I don't believe there was anybody else that had requested a deputation. Okay, then, councillors, we'll move on to the reports. So the first one is 7.1, which is the food truck event that Mr. Busby just spoke to. Could I maybe ask Mr. Gibson to give us a briefing on this firstly?
Thank you, Madam Mayor. This report is to enable council to consider an application for a local law permit to run a fortnightly food truck event at Ashfield Reserve. The event would involve up to 10 food trucks every second Thursday night, with the event located at the southern end of the reserve near Coulston Road. The determination of the application is guided by Council's recently adopted alfresco dining and public trading policy, with the proposal involving a number of variations that policy has set out in the report. In terms of the comment about the sale of alcohol, since the drafting of the report, the applicant has advised that alcohol is not sold nor proposed to be sold. And as a result of that recent clarification, the officer report will be updated in advance of next Tuesday. As detailed in the report, there's mixed views from local businesses and market operators, with the competition for customers being the main issue raised. Town staff formed the view that this is not, it's not unreasonable to have an event once a fortnight, and that the frequency of events should not unduly impact nearby businesses or market operators. It's therefore recommended that the application be approved, subject to conditions which would include, in addition to the ones currently listed, compliance with the council policy relating to single-use plastics. All that said, it's also open to council to refuse the application or to approve the application with conditions that change the frequency.
Thank you for that. Just in your report, you noted that there had been efforts made to try and reduce the impact on the local businesses. So, for example, I believe that it was pizzas weren't being sold because there was a business selling pizza. There was also mention from the kebab shop, which I believe is the same business. Are we permitting the food trucks to also sell kebabs and duplicate there? Is there scope to be able to reduce that concern by putting in another condition, not just around pizza, but including the kebabs?
Through you, Madam Mayor, yes, that's correct. There is no standalone pizza shop, but the kebab shop does sell pizzas, mm-hmm. but it would certainly be within the scope of the application and the determination of the application for council to impose whatever conditions it considers appropriate to mitigate the impacts.
Great, thank you. Questions, councillors? Councillor Gangell first, and then Councillor Hamilton.
Thank you, Worship. From memory, there was an event held, was it earlier this year, at Ashfield Reserve with the food trucks?
They've happened over recent months, these ones. Is this what you mean?
You're correct, yeah. Yes. Yeah, so they have been occurring, yes?
Yes.
Yeah. Do we have feedback on the success of those?
So in the attachments, Councillor Gangell, there's the feedback that's been provided.
Through you, Madam Mayor, if I can. The feedback from the attendees has been evidently positive, but the feedback from the nearby businesses has been mixed. The IGA, for example...
what I'm saying is, obviously, potentially, the applicant believes it's viable, but how many people have actually attended the event? Rough numbers, estimate numbers?
Through you, Madam Mayor, I don't have the numbers on hand, but having driven past for the last event, I'd say there would have been in the vicinity of 100 people, judging just by driving past.
So I believe the ladies at the back are part of this, so they may be able to provide some of that information between now and the council meeting if you require that, Councillor Gangell.
Thank you.
Councillor Hamilton.
This might be a side question, but I wanted to know if there are any bike racks near the food truck event.
Through you, Madam Mayor, we can certainly check and update councillors.
If there are, could we encourage the applicant to incorporate some bike-friendly promotion when they promote this event, but only if there are bike racks there, because obviously to encourage people to take other modes of transport down to the event would perhaps alleviate some of the parking issues that have been mentioned.
Through you, Madam Mayor, yes, certainly the town staff can engage with the applicant to see if that's a viable proposition.
Okay. I do have another question. I note on page 7 of the agenda that this event generates income for the town, revenue, and I do note the email response we got from another operator of a long-term market in the town. Am I correct in assuming that the long-term market operator has been given concessions to operate for the next couple of years that are not available to other market operators?
That's correct, through you, Madam Mayor. council in making its decision to hand over custodianship of the other markets. In doing so, council did grant some fee concessions, yes.
Okay. And that other market incorporates much more than just food trucks. I think the food trucks would only be a certain percentage of the that once a month event, wouldn't it? And I think if I look at the event, it would probably be less than 20% of the operators.
That's correct, through you, Madam Mayor. This event is largely centred around, exclusively centred around the sale of food, whereas the other event does have a slightly more diverse offering.
Thank you very much.
Councillor Barty.
Just noting the this report, one of the pieces of feedback was around the branding of the markets, referring to Bassendean, the title. Given that one of the proposed benefits of the markets is around the activation of Ashfield Reserve and Ashfield as a suburb, would there be scope for the branding of the markets to reflect that?
Through you, Madam Mayor, there would be some scope, particularly with the advertising located within the district, as distinct from advertising that might be outside the district or using digital platforms. So certainly conditions could be imposed on a local law permit regarding signage, physical signage in the district, and certainly staff can look at some wording about what restrictions would be reasonable to impose.
Thank you. Another one from Councillor Barty and then you, Councillor Hamilton.
Just as a follow-up, in regards to traffic management for the event, does that
responsibility
sit with the town or with the proprietor?
The trial period, which was a series of a small number of approvals to sort of gauge how it worked and gauge the level of interest, didn't, in the town's view, and town's rangers sort of attended the site a number of occasions, didn't suggest there was any major issue that would require formal traffic management. Typically, though, if formal traffic management was required, that would fall to the applicant. But in this instance, given the sort of the localised context, the number of people involved, the parking available, all the factors that make up that environment, it wasn't determined necessary that we need formal traffic management.
And Councillor Hamilton?
Would the staff engage with the applicant in the next week about the branding of their event to see if there's any scope for highlighting the Ashfield location? Perhaps bring that information back to us.
Sure.
I do have one other question, if you don't mind, through the Chair. Parking for the soccer club or the sports club, that's enclosed, isn't it, in mesh fencing with a gate. So would I be correct in assuming that the sports club have dedicated parking for their users?
Through you, Madam Mayor, broadly that's the case. If you look at the actual site of the Ashfield Reserve in the entirety, there's different parking zones. Some are located towards the southeast, towards the soccer club. Others are located towards the northwest and Guildford Road, which is effectively next to the town's facility there, opposite the shopping centre. So there is demarcation of the car parking bays, and the soccer car parking bays are separate from the bays provided for the senior centre.
So follow-on question.
Last one, Councillor
Hampton. Yep. This food truck event, it doesn't fall on a game day for the sports club. It falls on a training night. Is that right?
Through you, Madam Mayor, that is our understanding. It's a Thursday evening, which we believe is a training night, not a game night.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, everybody happy? Councillor Wilson?
I'm reading through the reports and I can't see it anywhere. Does the permit also allow for music or other forms of live entertainment to accompany the food trucks?
Through you, Madam Mayor, there is the applicant has provided in their proposal the inclusion of light entertainment and music. It would be within the scope of determination of the application to impose conditions about the particulars, whether that's allowed at all, if so, what times and any other restrictions that council would seek to provide.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right, if there's no more questions, we'll move on to the next item. So 7.2, it's amendment to the existing development approval for additions to the small bar patio at the Cork and Bottle. Mr. Gibson.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. This report's to enable Council to consider an application for minor physical works in relation to the patio and blinds located in front of the Cork and Bottle establishment on Old Perth Road. The application, whilst minor, is brought back to Council given the Council approved the last application and probably the one before that. Like I say, the works are relatively insignificant. They do not materially obstruct pedestrian movement. They don't have any impact on the streetscape and they don't affect any existing trees. It is therefore recommended that it be approved. But again, it's open to Council to make a different decision.
Councillor Hamilton?
So just clarify for me, what Council has been asked to do is to provide retrospective approval for unauthorised work. Is that correct?
Through you, Madam Mayor, it's broadly, but it's not retrospective. The approval is prospective. It does not... The force of the approval does not go back to when it was established. It is from the time Council approves it, if Council approves it. But broadly, Council is being asked to consider works undertaken without the appropriate permit.
Correct. So can I follow on with questions on that? So on page 10 of the agenda, the last paragraph states that the property owner of all four adjoining commercial properties is agreeable to these works. But may I ask if the actual tenants who operate these different tenancies have been asked?
Through you, Madam Mayor, no, as was the case with the last application. Staff formed the view, and in the absence of a policy or any other procedure to guide this, staff formed the view that the landowner who was there controlling who was in the tenancies was in fact the applicant. There would be little value in asking the tenancies who were only there because of the agreement of the applicant.
I think what Councillor Hamilton might be referring to is that when the previous application came to Council, that the preference was that for future applications that tenants were also considered because they're also
correct.
Valuable members of the community. Is that what you were...?
Yes, that's 100% correct. May I ask one more question from the Chair? I did visit the site before I was even aware of this item coming to Council. And I noted at the time that the applicant had taken it upon themselves to alter the existing limestone planter bed by removing a corner section. So existing limestone slabs have been cut to accommodate the half-wall partition that they put in there. Can a condition be added requiring the applicant to restore said limestone corners if and when the girder structure is removed?
Through you, Madam Mayor, absolutely. The town is aware that that work has occurred. In addition, if Council refuses the application and therefore does not authorise the works, town staff will take compliance action because the works will still have occurred but without any permit at any level. But in answer to your question, Councillor Hamilton, yes, certainly a condition to that effect can be imposed.
I will add to that, I was surprised that had happened because I actually mentioned at the last approval process that that corner intruded into the pagoda area. So I must admit surprise, and I'm not sure how... Can I ask the staff, how can we strengthen processes so that applicants don't take steps to do unauthorised works? Because clearly this happens regularly, not just at this site, but other sites as well.
Through you, Madam Mayor, I wouldn't suggest it's happening regularly. It certainly happened on this occasion. It's the town's role in this is sort of after the fact, rather than having someone out there policing individual sites. Things are brought to our attention from time to time. So there's not a lot the town can do beyond providing information and I suppose the threat of compliance or legal action or punitive action, but from time to time unfortunately works will occur without approval, and the options for council going forward from there are to authorise them after the fact, or not authorise them and then take that punitive action after the fact. But in terms of preventative measures, there's not a great deal the town can do, unfortunately.
Thank you for that.
Councillor Ganter?
Thank you, Your Worship. Just reminded me, just jog my memory. When this came to council previously, there was a Chinese tallow tree that the arbitrist said was of poor specimen, but the town expended...
Councillor Ganter, is this relevant to the decision that council's making?
It very much is relevant. Thank you, Your Worship. There's a question I wish to ask. The applicant had to expend thereabouts $2,500 for the tree to be replanted. I'm just wondering if the staff can advise where that tree has been replanted in the town.
I'll have to defer to my colleagues if I can, Madam Mayor.
Yes, I'll have to follow up on that and see where we planted it. I'm not
sure.
Thank
you very much. Looking very much forward to it.
But not relevant to the decision next week, Councillor Ganter.
Well, well,
any other questions, councillors? Okay, so we'll move on to item 7.3. It's the proposed single house at 31 Ashfield Parade in Ashfield. Mr. Gibson, once again.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. This introduction goes a bit longer, so please bear with me. This report is to enable council to consider an application for a development approval for a single house at 31 Ashfield Parade in Ashfield. It's been brought to council due to an objection received during the consultation period, with that objection citing the impact of building height and building bulk as the reason for lodging that objection. The assessment and determination of this application is guided by the residential design codes, with the codes setting out two different assessment streams, one being called the deemed to comply provisions and the other being called the design principles. The former is quite objective and binary. You either meet them or you don't. And the latter provides more scope for interpretation. And where an application does not meet the deemed to comply standards, they are entitled to an assessment under the design principles. And as you can see from the officer report, the application meets all required or relevant deemed to comply standards, with the exception of those relating to building setbacks and the building height. Those two elements have been assessed, as you can see in the table starting on page 17, and were considered to meet the design principles, and it's therefore recommended that the application be approved. It is open to council to refuse the application, but if it did so, it would be required to provide reasons relative to those design principles.
Thank you. Councillor Hamilton?
There's mention of an objection, and I can't find a copy of that in the report or the attachments. Could that be provided to councillors before the OCM? I do have other questions, if you don't mind.
Ask another, and then we'll see if anyone else has some questions. Councillor Hamilton.
Action N of the agenda, bottom paragraph, shows that the development does not comply with the provisions of the codes that permit an external wall up to 6 metres and an external wall with concealed roof up to 7 metres, in that this proposal has an external wall 6.7 metres and an external wall with concealed roof at 8.6 metres. Is this to make provision for the extra height? Is that to make provision for that third floor?
Through you, Madam Mayor, yes. And more specifically to the stairwell. And if you go to the... sheet 4 of 8 in the plans, you'll see the lift, the stairwell and the landing. It's the height is attributed to that aspect of it.
So just following on from Councillor Hamilton's question, because mine was similar, when you have a look at the elevation of that section, it is the southern northern is it, which aspect is it? The southern aspect of that which has the seems to impose the height problems. Is that just a design feature, or is that functionally required to accommodate the lift and the stairwell? Are you following me? So there, that aspect there.
Yep, thank you, Madam Mayor. If you go back to sheet 4 of 8, that shows that it's to accommodate the lift and the stairwell.
So you couldn't have the lift there without there being that degree of height?
That's correct.
So you could have a lift, but not if you wanted a lift that took you to a third-storey terrace.
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
Councillor Hamilton?
May I ask about the necessity of a double crossover? Could it not be a single crossover that expands out to a double width once inside the property line? I ask this with consideration of the subdivision aspect of the site, where another crossover will undoubtedly be built right next to the proposed double crossover. So clearly, we're in a town that is trying to reduce the number of crossovers and hearth surfaces. So I'm curious about whether there is potential to reduce that double crossover down in widths, because looking at the plans, correct me if I'm wrong, there is the ability to actually still enter two cars within the property line if it expands out once they're within the property line.
Through you, Madam Mayor, that element of the application complies with the deemed to comply provisions, so it's not up for Council's consideration.
So how do we as a Council address the proliferation of double crossovers throughout our town that are reducing our soft landscaping surfaces and our verges where we can plant trees? How do we reduce that? Because clearly these type of developments that have double crossovers with subdivision, with like Alex blocks as they're going to happen next door. Clearly this is increasing the volume of hard surfaces and crossovers on that particular existing site.
Through you, Madam Mayor, it is open to Council to adopt a local planning policy that varies elements of the deemed to comply provisions. So the R-codes do have that inbuilt ability that a local government can vary the deemed to comply provisions. However, depending on which provision it is, either Council can do it via its own local planning policy, or in some cases, depending on the element, it may require Commission approval to vary it. But staff can provide further information on that through the bulletin, perhaps.
That would be good to have more information so that we can keep it better educated in this.
Other councillors with questions? Did you have another, Councillor Hamilton?
Again, this is probably a question which is the bulk and the scale of the building in comparison to the minimal retention of landscape areas. Could staff remind me, because we're going up three stories, so clearly the idea is that, you know, if you're going high, you're reducing your footprint in an effort to get better outcomes. But this is not happening in this case. In fact, bulk and scale tends to take up a large portion of the block. So what is the actual requirement for retention of soft landscaping areas on a block like that?
Through you, Madam Mayor. Typically there's two protections, but in the town of Bassendean we've effectively got three. So the normal two are outdoor living areas, which you will see is provided for at the rear of the dwelling. That's sort of a small backyard, courtyard, contiguous space outside the dwelling. The other mechanism is open space generally. That's the amount of space that is undeveloped. So they're the two normal mechanisms to control bulk, scale, and ensure there's enough room around a dwelling and there's outdoor living area for the occupants. The town obviously has a third lever, which is its local planning policy, which requires the provision of either retention of trees or, in lieu of that, the provision of new trees. And this application complies with all three.
Any further questions, councillors? Councillor Wilson?
Thank you, Your Worship. So on page 19 of the agenda there in relation to the street retention provision policy, says the proposal complies by virtue of the provision of the medium tree. It will be recommended that conditions be imposed accordingly to other matters. Is it point 8 in the recommendation that relates to that, or is there something else?
Through you, Madam Mayor. Condition 3 is the provision of the actual tree. Mm-hmm. It goes on to say it needs to be retained for the life of the development. Condition 4 is the notification on title so that any subsequent purchaser knows that tree is effectively protected by a condition of approval.
Okay. Thank you.
Right, and so condition 8 is just proof of compliance from the 3 and 4, is that?
Through Madam Mayor, there's other landscaping scattered around the proposal in addition to the medium-sized tree, so that condition 8 captures that other landscaping.
Right, but does it also apply to the tree requirement in 3 and 4?
That's right, it requires them to maintain in perpetuity, but that's also supported by the notification to ensure anyone else that may own the property at some point in the future comes in eyes open.
Move on. Next item is 7.4. It's the proposed tree preservation order that Mr. Bell spoke to us about. You again, Mr. Gibson.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. This report is asking Council to consider making a tree preservation order over a tree on a property on 7th Ave in Bassendine. The matter, as you can appreciate, is reasonably contentious given with the tree overhanging into an abutting property and the owner of that abutting property objecting to the TPO. The owner that has nominated the tree has not provided an arboricultural report, as we've heard this evening, and the town's assessment, which Phil may be able to speak to a bit later, has concluded that the tree is in poor health and does not warrant a TPO. It is, of course, open to the council to make the TPO, and that would simply mean that approval is required from the town prior to anyone doing anything to the tree, including trimming or lopping. Or any other maintenance works. On a related note, the report also provides council the opportunity to grant delegate authority to the CEO to make TPOs where they are not contentious, which is something that we've been asked to investigate a number of times. Again, it's open to council to grant the delegation or not, in which case every TPO would come to council for determination.
Thank you. So Mr. Bell spoke about the potential for council to defer the decision on this item until they had the report that would give us a stronger indication as to whether the tree had been poisoned or not and its ability to recover. I can't see any issues with that proposal. Is there any issues from the staff's perspective?
No, Madam Mayor. The report, the application was lodged not that long ago and was brought to this June round of meetings at the request of the applicant, but there's certainly no objection from staff if there was to be a deferral to allow the applicant to submit some more information for Council's consideration.
Thank you. Councillor Barty?
Just a three header, if I may, triple header.
maybe one at a time.
I'm just interested to make sure I've understood the report correctly. Once a resident submits a TPO, is there, seems that there's been consultation with the landowner, the neighbour, but there hasn't been consultation with the person that's made the TPO once they've submitted that. Have I understood that correctly? Or?
Through you, Madam Mayor, I suppose the applicant or the nominator obviously puts the nomination to the town with any supporting information that they consider is relevant to enable council to make a decision. Obviously, the local planning scheme from there sets out the process going forward, and that is to consult with those that might be affected. Obviously, in this case, the abutting owner objects the TPO, and therefore council has that information before it to make a decision. But if council was to defer it to allow time for further information to be provided, that is okay. But yeah, the process followed is as outlined in the scheme.
Got two more, Chris.
And I was just, I suppose, in a procedural matter in relation to decision making. So obviously, if the council chooses to pass the TPO, then any action, remedial or otherwise, in relation to the tree needs to come through council. If the landowner, where the TPO is taking place, proactively puts forward, I apologise if I pronounce this wrong, an arboreal management plan, which is acceptable to council, could we approve that arboreal management plan and therefore avoid the necessity for future decisions to come to council?
Through you, Madam Mayor, just thinking through the procedural aspects, the scheme sets out that council can make a TPO, and that adds a layer of statutory protection, which requires anything that may happen to that tree to be pre-authorised by council or town. As the delegation may provide for. It could be that council could make a TPO, and if it was to accept the arboricultural management plan or similar, it might delegate authority to staff to take action so long as it is in accordance with that. That would simply relieve council from subsequent decision making, but that's probably jumping a few steps ahead of where we are now.
And just the third part, Member, thank you for your indulgence. The report just speaks to the safety risks associated with the tree. This might be an obvious question, but is the safety risk that if you're after it's going to fall over?
If I can, Madam Mayor, I suppose the decision before council is not about the physical maintenance of the tree, but it's on private land. I suppose the decision before council is to apply or not apply an additional statutory layer that would confer protection on the tree that doesn't otherwise exist. I think it would be reasonable to say, and I'm happy my colleagues to butt in, but if the tree isn't cared for by one or both owners, the tree would likely suffer. I think that's probably a reasonable point of view. But even having the TPO doesn't oblige the landowner to care for the tree per se. It simply regulates any works on the tree. So I appreciate it's a bit of a roundabout way. But the council's role in this is only to choose to apply or not apply an extra statutory protection.
Councillor Hamilton.
So on page 24 of the report, the last paragraph talks about the tree being dangerous and requiring to be made safe, but it also says here, whilst the town does not consider this, the town does not consider this action to be warranted at the moment to have an issue, a notice issue to remove the tree. That would only happen should the health of the tree further decline. So that's actually in the report. So my question is, at the moment, is it possible to put a temporary TPO on the tree for, say, a period of, say, 6 months, to be reviewed in 6 months' time to ascertain the health of the tree? Now, this may provide opportunities for the arborist report to be provided by the applicant, but it also gives us the opportunity to review the health of the tree. So my question is, can we do a temporary TPO to be reviewed in 6 months' time?
Through you, Madam Mayor. The scheme certainly allows council to make a TPO. Just bear with me, I'm finding the provision. Council also has the ability to repeal an order. So if council was to make one, say, next Tuesday, that's okay. It would also be open to council at any point in time in the future to review that decision and either maintain it or indeed repeal it.
So if I may, through the chair...
And then Councillor Ganchel.
Also on page 24 of the agenda, it states that the town considers that the tree could recover. So, again, my question is, if we accept a TPO with a review of that in 6 months' time, then clearly we can assess where the tree is at that point in time. Can I also ask about, because the whole reason this has come to council is because there are two branches that are showing health and they overhang the neighbouring property. So the way I'm reading the document is that the property owner is worried that those healthy branches, which may aid the recovery of the tree, will be cut off. So a TPO would prevent that, is that correct?
Through you, Madam Mayor, going back to the issue of compliance, a TPO wouldn't prevent that. A TPO would provide a requirement for an approval,
yes.
And if the work was undertaken without that approval, a breach would have occurred and there's a punitive action can result. The only thing that would stop a branch being cut is by no one cutting it.
Okay, correct. I stand correct. Thank you for that.
Councillor Hampton, maybe we'll give Councillor Gangell an opportunity to ask his question.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Your Worship. So I did raise earlier on about the arbitrary report the town got for a substandard species of a Chinese tallow tree on Old Perth Road that the town then has transplanted somewhere. We'll find out where soon. I also know in February we had a report to come to council for a tree preservation order in which the owners of the land disagreed with. The town engaged an arbitress to undertake an independent assessment of the tree. So we have a situation where I personally actually think this tree is actually a magnificent tree and would support a preservation order on the tree. So my question is, why then, when we have engaged an arbitrist for substandard species of Chinese tallow plus on land that the owner rejected having the trees with the tree preservation order, why have we not engaged an arbitrist in this instance for a tree that is obviously of substantial potential benefit?
For you, Madam Mayor, very broadly, I suppose, in terms of the other examples, I'd have to go back and actually check what precisely occurred, but with this particular situation, the tree was assessed by town staff who are considered to be an appropriate, have the appropriate expertise for that task. And that appraisal found or concluded, in their opinion, that the tree was in declining health. But like I say, if council chooses to defer the matter to allow the lodgement of subsequent information, that's okay. But otherwise, the information available to council at the moment is based on the review of town staff in the Parks and Gardens branch, who are appropriately qualified in the field, we think, and they've formed a view, and that's been provided to council.
Thank you. Councillor Hamilton?
I can't recall where I read it, but I think it may have been in one of the emails from the proponent direct to councillors that the proponent, the applicant, was willing to have branches that overhang the adjoining property braced in some way to minimise any potential dropping of branches. So if that is made a condition of the TPO, a temporary or a TPO which we may revoke later if the tree does not improve in health, would that assist officers in thinking that this could be a process that we can just delay for 6 months until we
Through you, Madam Mayor, probably 2 points there. It's certainly open to council to make a TPO and then have a subsequent resolution asking for staff to bring back a report in 6 months to consider whether it should be retained or repealed. That's a very neat way of giving in effect, a temporary TPO. In terms of putting conditions on the TPO, that's not something the scheme provides for. You either protect it or you don't. If the applicant or the landowner wants to do things to protect the tree and brace it and look after and care for it, that's okay. But the issue at hand is whether council wants to add that layer of statutory protection that would make it an offence for the owner to do anything to the tree without the town's consent.
So just back onto Councillor Gangell's point, I've gone back and looked at the November council agenda and the town did not engage an arborist to assess the Chinese tallow. The town staff undertook that assessment. Councillor Hamilton? Oh, sorry, Councillor Wilson.
So if a neighbour has a branch hanging over their property from a neighbouring tree, are they entitled currently to cut that branch off?
Through you, Madam Mayor, yes, unless otherwise protected, they could trim in line with the cadastral boundary.
And after they cut the branch off, what are they then required to do with the branch?
Ideally, through you, Madam Mayor, would be provided in the green waste collection, but it would. There is various schools of thought about what should happen with the branch, and I suppose from the town's point of view, it doesn't regulate that.
That's a matter for the common law,
so. Okay. We finished with questions for this one?
Oh, sorry, Your Worship, just a point of clarification. Was there not an arbitrary report done on all the trees in Old Perth Road?
So that was the Arbor Carbon report that was done several years ago.
Well,
it wasn't
was more recently.
No,
when you wanted to remove the Chinese tallow trees.
So that was several years ago now, and that was a general audit of all the trees. It wasn't a specific arborist assessment of each. Okay, so we'll move on to item 7.5. It's the review of various parking restrictions around Bassendean Oval. The star attraction, Mr. Gibson.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. This report is for Council to consider changes to parking restrictions generally around Bassendean Oval. It recommends that various changes are made, broadly moving away from signage on posts towards yellow lines on the actual road. The exception is, of course, Devon Road, where the local community wanted some level of restriction but didn't favour the yellow painted lines. In that location, it's simply recommended that the particulars of the sign restrictions are amended so as to prohibit parking on weekends.
Thank you. Councillor Hamilton.
Where to start on this one? I note in the comments by the officers that verge parking would not be affected by these changes. But is it not probable that these proposed parking changes will increase the incidence of verge parking? Because I note in some of the submissions that if they can't park on the road, some of these submitters have said that they will be obliged to park on the verge. So my assumption is it would increase verge parking. Would that be something you would agree with as an option?
Through you, Madam Mayor, broadly, the parking restrictions would, the yellow painted lines would make it an offence to stop on one side of the road. If this current situation accommodates parking on both sides of the road, stands to reason that there's reduced capacity on the roadway, and at least some of that would probably end up on the verge.
So with a follow-up question through the Chair, will potential increases in verge parking negatively affect the health of verge vegetation and trees, particularly if there are a significant number of vehicles parking right on the root zone underneath trees?
Through Madam Mayor, potentially, depending on the individual actions of individual drivers. Under the local law, as you'd imagine, it's an offence to damage a street tree, whether with a car or any other implement. But if there's greater parking on the verge, it would probably be reasonable to expect a bit more wear and tear on verge lawns and that sort of thing.
I do have one small question for the Chair. Can the staff provide photos of what the visual impact of the yellow line markers might be? Because I'm having a hard time visualising what that would be compared to the signage that we currently have. Would that be possible?
Through you, Madam Mayor, certainly. It's simply a yellow line about 100mm wide painted down the curb line.
Okay. There's a few examples around.
There is, but certainly we can provide photos. Mm.
I'm just curious because the preference seems to be for the no stopping with the yellow lines, which has only recently been incorporated into our local law policy, I forget which one. So is the preference to remove the need for signage and to make it clearer, or is there some other reason that it's preferred by the staff?
Through you, Madam Mayor, there's a number of reasons in terms of proliferation of signage. It's not uncommon to see a lot of signage, whether it's parking, bus routes, anything relating to verge protections, that sort of thing. So there is, I suppose, from a practical point of view, wanting to declutter the streetscape. There's the maintenance issue is reduced with yellow lines as opposed to signs, which occasionally are damaged or stolen or just general wear and tear. And from the user point of view, it's generally accepted, and the feedback we've got is that the yellow lines are much clearer because they run the length of the restriction, whereas the signs are provided intermittently.
Yeah, sorry, I wasn't very clear, because you did outline all of that in the report. I meant more in terms of instead of having a period where you couldn't stop or park, now having it consistent for the whole week? Is it, do you see any advantage of having it for the longer period of time by it being a permanent feature of the street?
Yes, Madam Mayor. One of the issues we encountered was that the restrictions you have to effectively foreshadow when there might be events at Bassendean Oval and therefore when you might want to control parking. That changes over time, depending on the particulars of the football season and any other events they might have there. And therefore, by setting out specific days and times and parameters, it might not catch everything, whereas we think the prohibition on the weekends is probably it's a simpler way of administering parking and results in less confusion.
Yeah. So this isn't really related to the decision for next week, but the report indicates that there's been changes to the times that games are played at the Oval, so the months that they're played, but also the days. So seemingly there's been quite an increase in the usage at the Oval. So not necessarily a question for now, but given that we've been talking about Swan Districts and the lease, I'd be keen to have an understanding about whether the lease has reflected the increased usage that this report has highlighted. So you don't need to answer that now.
I can probably touch on that, Madam Mayor. In some aspects...
It's not lease, so license agreement.
License.
Yes.
There's certainly games played on Sundays when it was typically only Saturdays. In terms of the span across the year, that hasn't really changed. It was probably more of a shortcoming with the town signage. It was just too narrow. Games of football going to September has been a long-established practice. So that hasn't changed at the football end. That was the shortcoming of the town signage. But certainly the increased use with the advent of women's football has led to a greater frequency of use on Sundays.
Thank you. Councillor Hamilton?
I'm interested in the thoughts of the staff one of the statements that caught my eye, submission 10 in the second survey, where the statement was made, residents shouldn't be further penalised by any new football parking issues. And I'm curious about, have Swan Districts Football Club incorporated the price of a ticket on public transport to get to the games as an alternative to cars? Because clearly, if they were going to go down that track, some of these parking issues would not be such an issue. So I'm curious about whether there has been any discussion about that aspect of Swan Districts incorporating transport tickets with public transport for their games.
Through Madam Mayor, we've actually asked that question of Swan Districts as part of a different discussion. But in any event, their answer was they've considered it but haven't pursued it. There is a cost to the club to enable the ticket to get you on public transport, and their view was that there's price sensitivities already and any additional cost would be impractical.
Thanks.
It's interesting, the tension between the residents' comments and that. I do have another question, if that's permitted. There's been several comments in some of the responses in the attachment from residents, something along the lines of, what's the point of some of these restrictions without follow-up enforcement? So will there be enforcement of these restrictions in the future if they're supported by council, rather than the, softly approach that we have at the moment?
Through you, Madam Mayor, I wouldn't expect any additional enforcement. Obviously the town has a small number of rangers to deal with a large number of issues across the district. Obviously if there was a desire from council to focus more on parking regulation and less on something else, that's certainly something we can look at. But through this report, it wasn't intended that we'd materially change our enforcement regime, which is broadly sort of education first, and some in the community support that, some don't. But we don't, we favour that rather than a purely and directly punitive response. Again, that is probably a philosophical thing that the council may have a view on, and can be certainly discussed separately, but behind this report there's no intention to materially change our enforcement regime unless otherwise advised by council.
I do have one more.
Okay, last one, Councillor Hamilton.
In considering this raft of parking changes, which are seemingly in response to increased sporting activity rather than other events at the Oval, has the administration developed an integrated parking plan that incorporates improvements in street amenity, for instance, increasing tree canopy and the like? And for that, I actually refer to comments from submission number 23, who made comments along that line in North Road, that you could, A, slow down traffic, and B, create parking by creating some, they come out with some tree parking, but parking, I don't know what that's called, it's not chicane, it's something else. But I want to know if the administration had considered a holistic process for these issues where we're looking at the whole street amenity rather than just the parking on the street or off.
Through you, Madam Mayor, short answer is no. There is no integrated parking plan that I'm aware of.
Thank you. Okay, if everyone has exhausted their questions, we will move on. I've jumped ahead, so we're on item 7.6 now. It's the disposal of number 122, Hamilton Street, Bassendean. Mr. Gibson, you are on again.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. This report's for council to consider the sale of a town-owned lot, which is located, as you've heard, on Hamilton Street and will ultimately have an area of 1,843 square metres. The lot is expected to be created in the near future, and it is recommended by this report that when it is created, it is sold via public tender as provided for by the Local Government Act. This represents a great opportunity for the town to facilitate the creation of up to 5 new dwellings and rationalise a lazy land asset in line with the objectives of the SCP.
Thank you for that. Can you help me to understand, in the proposal there's the 1,400 metres that has already been retained and filled and so on, and then I understand there's the additional 443 square metres which hasn't been retained and filled. When the larger lot was proposed to be part of the land swap, my understanding was that it was contaminated, which was why council invested the money in remediating that site. That smaller strip that hasn't been retained, do you have an understanding what the status is there?
In terms of contamination?
Yeah.
That was decontaminated at the same time.
It wasn't
retained and filled,
okay.
But it was decontaminated.
Great. And is there a reason why it's been proposed that the two are amalgamated instead of looking to sell the two lots separately, given that they're distinctly separate at the moment?
Through you, Madam Mayor, given that there's been no development on either one, we thought it would give it the best chance of being sold, as it would represent a 5-unit site. You could sell them separately if council so chooses, which would leave you with a 4-unit site and a single site. The issue there is that the single site, because of its width and depth, makes it a bit tricky to develop upon, and whereas staff favour simply putting the whole site out to market, and if someone decides, if the ultimate purchaser, assuming there is one, decides that they want to keep them disparate and develop 4-in-1, and they can make that work, staff think it's best to provide that opportunity to whoever buys it rather than enforce it upon someone.
And is there a cost involved in the amalgamation?
There is, Madam Mayor.
Do you have an indication of what that might be?
It's in the thousands. It's more administrative as opposed to any sort of physical works. Obviously, the town could choose to undertake the physical works and actually retain to the ultimate edge, but we think that obviously would be money that would undermine any sale revenue, and again, rather than sort of seeking to preempt what a developer might want or do, just selling it as is and investing as little as possible to get it to a point where we can sell it.
Yeah,
Thank you. Councillor Wilson?
So the application to amalgamate the blocks, can you remind me when we decided that? When the last time that came before council? The application to amalgamate the blocks. I can't remember when we decided to do that, so...
Through Madam Mayor, I'm not sure that did come to council.
So was there a decision made on the board on that case?
That's correct, Madam Mayor.
Did you have a question, Councillor Hamilton? No? Okay. Any further?
So that delegation, how far does it extend?
Through Madam Mayor, we'd have to check the particulars on that and report back to council.
Thank you.
So can I confirm then that section on the exercise of the delegated authority be included in the report for next week's council?
I actually do have a question.
Yes,
443 square metre section is not filled up to the height of the adjoining block. Are there intentions to fill that up to the adjoining height?
Through Madam Mayor, no. As the report sets out, is that we would be seeking to issue clearance without that work being undertaken, but with notifications on the title advising prospective purchasers that the site is being sold as is.
Would there be a cost differential if the two sites were to remain separate and then a potential buyer would have the option of purchasing both or one of the two? What do you think the cost implications of providing that option would be?
Through your Madam Mayor, there'd be no cost to the town in actually doing it. Whether that generated the same revenue as a sale of a consolidated site, or more or less, I honestly don't know.
Councillor Hamilton?
This is a curiosity question which probably cannot generate an accurate answer, but in this market where property is selling very quickly, would you not generate the most income from an auction of the sites? Just out of curiosity.
Through Madam Mayor, potentially, I suppose my experience in this has probably demonstrated that in WA people are reasonably reluctant to engage in auctions. But that said, Council thinks that that's a viable proposition. The Local Government Act provides specifically for that. And so, therefore, council could seek to dispose of it via public auction in the first instance.
I think I was more interested in perhaps the feedback from the real estate industry, because they would have a better idea of what the market's doing. I don't know. So I was curious about...
So you're asking if we could have a conversation with...
Well, there's lots of real estate agents. I'm just curious about whether auction rates in WA and Perth are actually... because I know that they're very hot in Queensland, and the auction rates, clearing rates over there are something like 95%. But I'm not... I haven't been watching them over here in Perth, so I don't know. But real estate agents would know.
Through them, if I can. Having been involved in this process a few times... People are, like I say, reluctant to engage in auctions. They're only slightly more engaged in a public tender process. So it may well be that a public tender process doesn't actually deliver the result council wants. However, going through that step will allow council to embark on a different process, which is effectively private treaty, which is the way the bulk of the properties are sold in WA.
Okay. Let's move on then. So item 7.7, it's the review of existing council policy 5.5, disused vehicles.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. I assume.
Yes.
This report is asking council to amend an existing council policy that's not been reviewed since 2014. The policy relates specifically to disused vehicles on private property and seeks to ensure that vehicles do not have a detrimental impact on the visual amenity of a local area. The policy does actually have some use, but it is considered appropriate to amend it to broaden the scope to cover off all disused materials, not just disused vehicles. And it's considered to strike a balance between the ability to store things on private land and the need to sort of maintain a quality streetscape from a visual amenity perspective. It's therefore recommended that the amended policy be adopted.
Thank you. Any questions, councillors? Okay, so 7.8 then is the revocation of existing council policy 5.22, reserve sponsorship signage. Mr. Gibson?
Thank you, Madam Mayor. This report's asking council to revoke an existing council policy that also wasn't reviewed since 2014. The policy relates to signage on the town's reserves, but does not actually provide any sort of decision-making guidance, and therefore is of little value. Revocation of the policy will not inhibit an application for signage being made under the relevant local law. And going back to one of the comments that were read out earlier, revocation of the policy, because it doesn't have any decision-making guidance, doesn't have much of an impact. So it won't provide additional freedoms for signage. Applications will still need to be made, they'll still need to be assessed, they'll still need to be determined. This policy wasn't helping with any of that, so really nothing has changed. So if someone wants to, say a sports club wants to put signage up at the reserve where they're based, they can and have always been able to make an application, and it will be assessed and determined.
Thank you. And you're referring to the statement that was submitted by Mr. Kelly from the Ashfield Sports Club. Any questions, councillors? No? Okay, so 7.9 is the draft amended local planning policy number 16, control of advertisements under local planning scheme number 10 for final adoption. Mr. Gibson?
Thank you, Madam Mayor. Last one. This report's asking council to consider an amended local planning policy relating to signage. Council does have a current policy, but it hasn't been reviewed since 2010. The draft policy seeks to improve the control of signage and, amongst other things, includes exemption criteria for each type of advertisement. It was previously considered by council last April, where council resolved to advertise for public comment. We did that, and no submissions were received, and therefore it's recommended that council adopt the policy.
Thank you. Queries, councillors? Okay, 7.10 then is council policies relating to debt recovery, financial hardship and rates exemption. And Mr. White.
Thank you, Madam Mayor.
Mr. Gibson is sharing the limelight.
So council adopted four policies in May last year. Primarily in relation to rates, recovery of rates and service charges policy, recovery of sundry debts policy, essentially regarding the rates, financial hardship policy and rates exemption policy, which deals with waivers and concessions as well. And this report provides an update 12 months in on the implementation of those policies. I'd just like to draw Council's attention to some of the highlights. I think they've been fairly successful in the first 12 months of operation. The town's rates debt has reduced from almost $1 million to $688,000, which is a reduction of 30%. 83 of the 239 debtors have paid in full in response to some engagement with the town's rates officers. 30 debtors have been referred for debt recovery action, and the town has assisted or is in the process of assisting 29 debtors under the town's financial hardship policy. The policies are, in staff's opinion, operating effectively, and only one minor change is recommended, which is simply to reduce the reference to interest rate percentages in the recovery of rates and service charges policy to prevent movement every time the regs might make change to those interest rate percentages.
Great, Devin, thank you. That sounds like a really positive result. I just had a couple of more questions just to help my understanding. So I'm not sure, the numbers seem to be slightly different from what you mentioned just then. But in the report you said that 10 of the debtors have been referred for legal, to see as legal for debt recovery. Is there a reason why only 10 have been?
10?
Yeah, so that's on page 49 of the report.
Sorry.
That's those dot points, I think.
I'd have to find follow that up. I think, I'll have to follow that up, Madam Mayor, and provide information back to Council for that.
That's fine. And just out of interest, if we do pursue debt recovery, that would incur a cost to the town. Does that cost then later get passed on to the recalcitrant ratepayer if we're successful in getting the outstanding payment from them, or is that just a cost that the town has to cover?
Yes, through you, Madam Mayor. The Local Government Act allows us to pass on costs of recovery action. Right. So that's done if at all possible.
And so just another query of interest. The deceased estates, I would have assumed that we would have, outstanding debts would be finalised before an estate, I don't know what the word is, settles. Is there something that we can do in those situations? Or?
Through you, Madam Mayor, I think it's just a matter of the passage of time,
right.
Given that it can generally sometimes take quite some time for probate to come through. So once probate comes through and the estate's finalised and the ownership of the property ultimately changes hands to the beneficiaries, then the town will recover its the outstanding debt as part of that process.
Thank you. Other questions, councillors? Councillor Wilson?
So there's some commentary there in relation to the rights exemption policy.
Yes.
On page 51 there, and I'm saying that a number of applications were received and then the applications were made by charities or entities that had charity status, but because they were providing residential accommodation, it was deemed that it was not used for an exclusively charitable purpose. So I'm just trying to understand, I guess, where the difference between the alleviation of poverty as a charitable purpose is and where it might stray into something that might be considered commercial.
Okay, I'm through you, Madam Mayor. It is, it's not necessarily a clear-cut issue, and I think different local governments have different positions on this issue. Primarily, the properties within the town of Bassendean are for the provision of some form of community housing by a not-for-profit, so they're definitely registered charities, definitely a charitable component. The Local Government Act defines properties rateable or not rateable, and it's on the use of the land as to whether the land is rateable or not rateable. And it's certainly the administration's view that in these cases the use of the land is to provide residential accommodation in the same circumstances as any other property within the town of Bassendean, which would house residents. Many of the agreements, many of the properties are provided under agreements with the state government, the former housing authority, and many of those agreements contain clauses that make the not-for-profit liable for any council rates and charges and fees and so on. So the administration's carefully assessed each and every one of these applications over the last 2 years since I've been at the town, and probably well before that, on their merits. So each individual application contains an application for multiple properties generally that they own. So we've considered each of those on their merits and made an administrative decision. The applicants have been informed of those decisions in all cases. And they do have the right to request a review of that decision and subsequent appeal rights to the State Administrative Tribunal.
Thank you.
Councillor Barney?
First, just to offer my congratulations to the staff on the merit so far. $300,000 is no small chunk of change, so absolutely well done. Just interested in that sense then. Just noting in terms of the level one ratepayers that have rates outstanding for 3 or 4 years, we had 30 assessments referred, but we've only had 4 successful instances of residents entering into payment plans versus considerably more success with level two outstanding ratepayers. Just wondering if we have some sense as to why that may be and what lessons we may learn from this moving forward.
Okay, through you, Madam Mayor. Thanks, Councillor Bardia. There's a couple of reasons for that. Firstly, the category one, which is the term we sort of use to place our more recalcitrant ratepayers in, they're generally fairly long-term debtors who may not have, in most cases, haven't actually made a payment at all to the town for at least the last 2 years, and in some cases longer than that, in some cases 3 or 4 years. So these people have received rates notices every year, final notices every year, demands every year, and haven't acted upon them. So they're naturally a bit more difficult in relation, a difficult category in relation to recovery attempts. And secondly, we believe that we've tried to give these people every opportunity, and so the referral to the legal firm for recovery action has only occurred very recently. I think it was about the 12th of May. So I think it's fairly early on in that process. So I would hope that over the coming months we'll have a little bit more success in relation to that group of debtors.
Councillor Wilson?
Have any of that group of debtors expressed views along the lines that local government doesn't exist and is a legal fiction and that they are sovereign citizens who are not required to pay that?
Three, Madam Mayor. Not that I'm aware of. Our experience with most of the debtors is there's been no contact whatsoever.
Thank you. Okay, everybody happy to move on? All right, so item 7.11 is the workforce plan and the minor review. So I'm going to move that to the end of the agenda because both of the attachments are confidential. So I imagine most of the questions councillors may have will be coming from those attachments. So we'll go now to 7.12, which is the behaviour complaints policy code of conduct for council members, committee members and candidates, which councillors had a workshop on recently with two representatives from WELGA. Our CEO, this is your report. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. Just to advise councillors, items 7.12 and item 7.13 are interrelated, so it's hard to refer to one without the other. So one relates to a new behaviour complaints policy, which falls out of the new code of conduct, which was commissioned on the 3rd of February. And the item 7.13 relates to a complaints committee, which will effectively proposed be set up to help manage any complaints that arise as a result of the complaints policy. So just a little bit of background. The new model code of conduct for councillors, candidates and committee members became effective on the 3rd of February this year. And at the time, no complaints framework for where alleged breaches occur was provided to local governments. And by way of response, WELGA developed a model complaints policy. It's important to understand that the new complaints policy only addresses behavioural complaints in Division 3 of the Town's Code of Conduct. Those in Division 4 remain the jurisdiction of the Standards Panel. The draft policy represents WELGA's model template, with the exception of some minor changes that have been highlighted for councillors. The policy deals with the process from when a complaint is first received by the complaints officer. And you may recall a few months ago, both Paul White and myself were appointed complaints officers for the town of Essendean. So when a complaint is first received by the complaints officer to the conclusion of the matter and any action that may be required. The policy allows for a complaints officer to appoint an independent person with the expertise to assess and investigate the complaint. This is designed to reduce the perception of bias and ensure procedural fairness. The policy also promotes the establishment of a complaints committee, which is our second item, which is the subject of the next item. The committee shall be delegated authority from council to make findings, dismiss complaints and prepare and implement plans to address the behaviour where a finding has been made. The condition of the delegation requires that in order for the committee to exercise its function, it is a requirement that any appointed committee member identified in the complaint as either the complainant or the respondent will recuse themselves from the committee meeting. That said, Welga State Council in December 2020 supported a position of establishing an office of an independent assessor to receive, investigate and assess complaints against elected members, candidates and committee members, and removing the CEO from being involved from processing complaints. But in the interim, and likely for at least the next 12 months, we're required to develop a framework in order to manage any potential investigations and the determination of behaviour complaints against council members, candidates and committee members. The recommendation from Welga State Council also includes advocacy and external oversight body as outlined. Now, whether councillors would like to ask questions in respect to the policy or whether you'd also like to go on to the committee as well, because they are interrelated.
Do you want to speak to the committee and then we can ask the questions about both at the same time? Is that okay with you, Councillor Hamilton?
So I guess just on the back of the previous item, the Establishment of Complaints Committee seeks to provide a mechanism for council to deal with behavioural complaints and manage conflicts of interest. Again, Welga has come to the rescue and developed a template, which is effectively what we've presented to council. The terms of reference outline the role and the authority of the committee, as outlined in the recommendations. The terms of reference include the provision of four councillors to be members and three councillors to be deputy members of the complaints committee. Now, councillors may wish to rethink that proposal, and it may be that council would all like to be part of that committee. So that is definitely an option. As mentioned, the committee is proposed to have delegated authority from council to make findings, dismiss complaints, and to prepare and implement plans to address the behaviour of councillors, committee members or candidates. So they're the two proposals that are on the table this evening.
Thank you. Councillor Hamilton.
So will referring complaints to an external body cost the town money?
Councillor Hamilton. That is still a concept that is being explored, it is something that obviously somebody will need to fund the existence of an oversight body.
No, so I think Councillor Hamilton is talking about with this current policy.
Current says, refer complaints to an external body.
So the independent assessor is what she's referring to.
Oh, okay, yeah. Yes. So the idea is being that we would procure an independent assessor and investigator.
So at likely a cost?
At a cost.
Right, okay. So we refer complaints to an external body to prepare a report, but then comes back to a complaints committee made up of councillors.
That's correct.
So we'll spend money to go out to an external person to make a report that then comes back to the council where the complaint originated to make a determination.
Yes. This is why Welga State Council has advocated.
I was there at the workshop, yes. And my mouth was open to the floor at that point in time. It still is. I'm sorry. I'll leave it to other councillors.
Councillor Ganjo?
My understanding from the workshop is that we don't need to go to an external consultant.
So somebody will need to investigate if there's a complaint and the complaint is assessed and there is some substance to it.
Just to clarify, Councillor Ganjo, are you referring to the conversation that was had about, and I forget what the correct terminology is, but an alternative...
dispute resolution.
Well, I'm sure I heard that you could do it in house. You didn't have to go out into an internal
for alternate dispute resolution or for an investigation. So alternate dispute resolution is offered first off.
Yes.
But it's something that must be agreed between the complainant and the respondent.
Yeah.
But if there is no agreement, the complaint is likely to proceed.
Yes.
And if it does require investigation, what is being recommended is an independent investigator be procured.
So what I'm asking is there a requirement for that to happen, or can it be done in-house? There's no legislative requirement that says we must go out and an independent body. We can do that in-house and present the report to the committee.
I think there may be some difficulties, and that is one of the problems with this approach, is that there is some potential for conflicts of interest.
So can I just not ask, I'm going to bring in Ms. Kenya here. Is that not something Ms. Kenya could actually do and prepare a report for the committee in the town? Is that not her specialty?
The problem may be is if the CEO is involved and Ms. Kenya reports to the CEO, there would be the potential for bias. So the idea is that it is an impartial process, there's procedural fairness and a level of independence.
Yeah, I think it can be done for the
answer. Would it, just your comment then, like you said, if the CEO was involved, but if it was any staff member, so if a member of the executive,
absolutely,
for example, was the complainant, it then also would create problems or potential problems for conflicts.
There are, I guess, conflicts in what has been proposed, and WELGA's complaints management framework, what they've presented, tries to best manage this challenging situation. But there is some advocacy work happening at a state level to try and change this complaints management framework. But it is likely we're going to be stuck with this model for 12 months.
Councillor Wilson.
Does that advocacy include this, suggesting that the state government just maintain a board that can handle this instead of 140 odd local governments having it duplicated?
Yeah, and that's pretty much what point two of the recommendation is.
Yeah. So back in, I think it's December 2020, Councillor Wilson, WELGA State Council, because it has come through as a recommendation in a number of...
Are you okay, Councillor Kanja?
Well, the design of this place is horrible, and the PowerPoints are underneath the table. So for me to get to my laptop, which, by the way, my agenda is on, I'm using my phone at the moment, I had to try and reach down, and I fell off my chair.
We're glad you're okay.
No, I'm always just fine.
So it's been a recommendation that's come through successive inquiries, that there be an independent oversight body. So this regulation has been implemented, and we're in this situation, and it's making the best of the situation until that is changed.
And the advocacy tick box that we have, is it open to council to advocate in that regard, to having some kind of sensible, well-trained, centrally administered and consistent body to deal with these matters?
In terms of independent investigators?
Just more broadly, is it open to council to advocate in relation to sensible outcomes for the management of these issues?
So
do
you mean 2B, point 2B on the resolution? Is that what you mean? So 17.12. Does 2B cover your...
I've been looking at the wrong agenda.
Possibly, that would be confusing for you.
Yes.
So on page 60, down the bottom, supports an external oversight body to manage local level complaints involving council members as prefaced in the Local Government Review Panel Report, City of Perth Inquiry Report and Select Committee.
That's what that means.
Is that what you were?
Sorry, I got confused because it's in the passive voice, so maybe it's open to council to reword it in the active voice.
Okay. Oh, sorry, Councillor Hamilton.
This is just an idea which I will throw at you, and perhaps the administration might consider exploring this idea before this OCM next week. Would it be possible to engage with some of our neighbouring councils to see if we can have a relationship where their complaints officer might deal with our complaints and vice versa and save us money?
Depends on how many complaints our neighbouring councils are generating, really, Councillor Hamilton.
Well, I'm curious about, like, for instance, we belong to the Eastern Region, which has six councils. Is there some scope there to to save some financial component for all six member councils in either having their own independent complaints committee or whatever you'd like to call it. I don't know. I'm just throwing an idea out there to the administration to see if other minds can put their head to that to see if there's any scope for something that will save us money.
Certainly. I'm happy to give you a call tomorrow if you like and we'll have a bit more of a talk about
this. This is a thought on the run.
Yep.
All right, everyone's happy. We'll go to 7:14, which is the festive season closure period.
Thank you. So last festive season, we received really positive feedback from staff who were able to take an extended break and enjoy time with family over the festive season. This year, we're proposing the same, an extended shutdown period. Also avoids the need for payment of higher duties and helps the town clear its leave liability, which are both positive from a financial perspective. It is proposed a half-day break on 17th of December for the end-of-year function for staff and councillors, and then closing our doors from the 24th of December to January the 7th inclusive. Wind in the Willows and Seniors and Disability Services are slightly different in the closing dates, but we'll communicate with the families and clients. And skeleton staff will be operating during the shutdown period.
Thank you. Any questions, councillors? Councillor Wilson?
Under the employment agreements or collective agreements that are in place, what's the only entitlement for the employees going?
For that period or?
Oh, no, per year, sorry.
Per year. So it's the 4 years. Four weeks.
Okay, and so is this in addition to those 4 weeks or requiring workers to take leave during these periods?
It's requiring workers to take leave during this period.
Any other questions?